All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Angela Davis. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and each Wednesday on this show, we're spending time talking about mental health conditions and how they can be managed. Today, we are focusing on one that mental health professionals classify as a serious mental illness, schizophrenia. It's rare. Many of us can barely spell it. Most of us know very little about exactly what it is. And there are a lot of misconceptions out there about this condition. This hour, we'll talk about the most common symptoms, hallucinations and delusions, and the treatment options that are available by talking with a woman who is living with schizophrenia, plus a doctor who treats patients with this illness. And I also want to hear from you. What questions do you have about this disorder and how it affects a person who has it? You can call in at 651-227-6000 or reach out on Twitter. I'm at Angela Davis, MPR. Let me introduce my guest today. We have Dr. Marielle Demaray, a psychologist with Hennepin Healthcare, who works with people living with schizophrenia and other mental illnesses. Thanks for being here, Doctor.
Thank you.
We also have Christy Furness here, a Twin Cities artist who is living with schizophrenia. She works as a peer support specialist at Avivo, which is a Minneapolis agency that provides services to people with mental health concerns and other issues. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning.
So, Christy, I do want to start with you because I do believe that there are a lot of misconceptions about schizophrenia, mainly because people just don't know a whole lot about it. And I also think that there is some fear associated with it. Have you found that to be true?
Yes.
Yeah. And what do you hear from people when they're discussing schizophrenia?
They are pretty scared. Like they immediately think of violence. And that's absolutely not true. I was in a situation where this gentleman asked me what I did. And I said, I work in a drop-in center for adults with mental illness. And he was like, good for you. Good for you. And he goes, and I said, yeah, it's a safe space where people can go and hang out and be themselves. And he was like, yes, there must be a lot of security. And I thought to myself, no, it's a safe space where people can go to be away from people like you that are scared of us.
Because he wasn't aware of
he was completely unaware that I had a diagnosis. Yes.
So why is it important for you to talk publicly about schizophrenia?
Well, when I was first diagnosed, I had to look up schizophrenia online, and that is terrifying. I didn't even know the word existed. I had no idea there was a mental health system that I was about ready to go through. And I know that people living with mental health, one of the worst parts of it is the isolation. So I want to be a voice to let people know that there is recovery and you can thrive with a mental illness. With schizophrenia, you can be happy and thrive. It's not a gloom or doom diagnosis. There are bad days for sure, but it's a chronic illness, but it's treatable.
How old were you when you received your diagnosis?
I believe I was 24. So I was having symptoms before that, but it got dangerous at 24. So I sought help.
What was happening in your life at that time that brought you into a doctor to get some help?
I was having stress at home and I was in a job that I didn't feel like it made a difference. I was an administrative assistant, and I was my job was to file things. And I know it's important to file things, but I had recently quit my job at the American Cancer Society, where I felt like I was curing cancer. I feel like, for me, I feel like I need to be working towards a goal mm-hmm. of helping people. So I was really not happy at my job. And at my apartment, I was living with an ex-girlfriend, and we were not getting along. So there was a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. And then I just woke up one day and said, you know, I'd rather die than go to work. And so I actually attempted suicide. And when I changed my mind, I called a local clinic and I said, I need to talk to a psychiatrist because I think I need meds. I don't know where that came from, but they're like, oh, why do you feel like you need meds? And I said, because I just tried to kill myself. And it was very matter of fact to me, but they demanded that I not hang up, and they got me on the line with a crisis therapist. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so she talked to me, and she's like, do you feel like killing yourself now? And I'm like, no. And she's like, well, I have an appointment on Thursday. Can you promise me that you won't attempt it until Thursday? And I'm like, sure, I'll make this appointment on Thursday. And so it was difficult, but I got help pretty close. She became my therapist for a while. And that's where it all started with my journey in the healthcare system, was reaching out to because I had heard of an antidepressant mm-hmm. before.
I want to, you know, I mentioned some of the common symptoms, and we'll talk to Dr. DeMaria about this in just a moment, but that delusions and hallucinations are common symptoms. Were you experiencing those?
Yes. I had delusions of a war among dimensions. And I didn't really talk about that to anybody, but I felt that there was energy around me that I couldn't explain. So that was delusional. And then I did hear auditory hallucinations. I had later on, we coined him the Dark Man, but this very rough male voice telling me to harm myself. And so I did have hallucinations. Most of my hallucinations are auditory, although I do have sometimes I feel like things are crawling on my skin as well. So I have different kinds of hallucinations, but
and so today you are receiving treatment with a doctor. Yeah. And how would you describe how you're managing
schizophrenia? It's every aspect of my life I'm managing my illness. So I have a psychiatrist that I see, and I am finally on a cocktail of medications that work for my symptoms. I have a therapist that is wonderful and doesn't take anything from me that, you know, she doesn't let me get by mm-hmm. with anything. And then I have my friends and family who have been so supportive over the years. My wife, Ruth, who is the main person that helps me manage my care. And then I have my work at Avivo, which gives me purpose.
Because you're talking with other,
well,
other people.
Yeah, it's really fulfilling mm-hmm. work. I'm working in the art department, Avivo Artworks, and I get to see people have fun who are otherwise having a rough time. They come in, and they get to be themselves and work on a project that they want to work on, and I help them find the art supplies they need. And how mm-hmm. how wonderful is that?
So, Dr. DeMarais, you've been nodding this whole time. Christy's story, does this sound familiar to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think for so many people, the story is very familiar in that sense that life all of a sudden starts to become confused, stress is increasing. For many individuals, they're starting to experience these symptoms of schizophrenia in their late teens, early 20s.
That early? That seems early.
It is. It's also a really difficult time of life because that's the time when most people are starting to get into their work or they're pursuing the education in high school or after high school. They're starting to increase their independence away from family and then to develop an illness that is a chronic illness, absolutely treatable, but something that also requires a lot of really intensive hard work for learning how to manage. It comes about at a time that is just complex and challenging. And so, you know, I have the privilege of getting to hear these stories of people's experiences that for many, their first interaction with the mental health system is because things get to a really scary place, like you were talking about, Christy, and the person themselves or family calls 911. Their first interaction with the mental health system might be an inpatient hospitalization. And that can be a really scary place. It can be incredibly confusing for individuals, for their families. It's hard to learn how to navigate that system. And so I think being able to connect with providers that can offer some education, information, support, create a safe place for helping people and their families learn about what they're going through and how can they help themselves in recovery is really critical and really important for people's well-being.
So, Doctor, let's talk about the definition of schizophrenia and what sets it apart from other mental disorders. So a very basic description of what this is.
So schizophrenia is a serious mental illness, like you said, that's predominantly characterized by symptoms of psychosis. So those are hallucinations we had talked about. Basically, they're any kind of extrasensory experience. There can be auditory hallucinations. Many individuals hear voices or other sounds. They might hear music playing that people around them aren't hearing. There can be visual hallucinations where objects in their actual environment become distorted or they're perceiving things in the environment that others aren't seeing. Tactile hallucinations, like Christy mentioned, where you're feeling something on your skin or in your body. And then there's also delusions. So delusions are any false belief or illogical thought that isn't grounded in sort of facts from reality. And those can take numerous different forms. For many people, they can involve perceptions that people are out to get them or that there are different plots or conspiracies going on. There can be delusions that are grandiose in nature where people believe themselves to be the second coming of Christ or a very famous, important person. And I think those can be particularly isolating experiences because for the person living with that delusion in those moments, it's 100% true for them.
It's a belief.
It is absolutely a belief held with 100% conviction. And the world around them doesn't see it that way. And so it can further contribute to a sense of alienation, a sense of isolation. And it's hard, I think, then for families to understand what their loved one is going through. You know, many families try and just talk them out of that or point out all of the evidence that goes against that belief. And we know that during a really acute phase of these symptoms, simply pointing out that that thought is illogical isn't actually going to change
help.
The belief.
And Christy, I see you nodding. What she described is that some of what you found and
yes, it's it gave me another thought. Also, when you're first seeking treatment and you have these very solid thoughts of what is going on, and then you start to take medication and you have everybody in your life telling you your thoughts are wrong, it is really scary. It is really scary. So you start to doubt yourself, your own thoughts, and that's a really terrifying time, or at least it was for me. Like, I thought that I had this important job to save the earth, and then all of the sudden, I'm like, I have this horrible diagnosis, and I have taking meds that make me sluggish, and you know, it's just, it seems like it was the end of the world at that time, you know.
So the medication, does it take, it takes time for it to build up into your system to have an impact? Or what was that like when you first started taking medications?
When I first started taking medications, I was not compliant, which is a term that I would suggest people not use. Because if you tell me to be compliant with something, I'm not going to be compliant.
What is that?
Compliant.
When I would, like, do what I tell you to do is what,
yeah,
compliant,
I would
indicates, right?
Sporadically take my meds. I would not feel well. I would take my meds. I would sleep for days. And then I'd wake up and I'd feel fine. I would not take my meds. And then I would feel bad a couple of days later.
Cycle.
And I'd take my meds. And it was a continuing loop for a long time.
But when you were on medications, did that help alleviate the symptoms? Did the voices go away?
It did. It helped a little bit in the beginning. Mm-hmm. It does take some time to be consistent with the medication. And also at the time, I was self-medicating because I was having problems sleeping. And so if you interact other substances, like the meds they had given me to help me sleep, I had decided was poison. Because the side effects were just not acceptable to me, but I didn't know how to communicate that to my psychiatrist. So I just left them alone, and then I would try to drink myself to sleep.
And we know that sleep is a factor in, you know, I guess, worsening symptoms. Mm-hmm. Is that correct, Doctor?
Yeah. So I think there's a number of things that can contribute to worsening symptoms. So certainly when sleep patterns are being disrupted, if, you know, other physical health needs aren't being taken care of, if you're not getting adequate nutrition and exercise and having a sense of purpose to your day, all of those different factors can contribute to worsening symptoms or a return of symptoms. We know that medications, specifically antipsychotic medications, can be very effective. They're quite effective for many people in alleviating hallucinations and delusions. The science behind it is not a perfect science. And so often individuals' experiences are having to try one or two or three different antipsychotic medications and to adjust the dosages to find what that right amount, what that right, you know, cocktail is for you individually. And these are medications that come with some very significant side effects. One of the most common side effects that people experience is sedation. So they take the medications, they're very sedating, people feel tired, they sleep for long periods of time, they're sluggish in the morning, it's hard then to get up and go to work or school or to spend time with friends. When side effects are so aversive, it's difficult for people to want to stay on a medication.
Right.
And
it's
so,
creating a new problem.
Exactly. So in the HOPE program that I run and in a lot of other areas of psychiatry, we're moving towards joint decision making, where we're trying to help facilitate really interactive conversations between individuals and their psychiatrists. So if they're having a bad side effect, they can come to their psychiatrist or their prescriber and say, I am too tired on this medication, and then work collaboratively together to find some better solution, because we know that consistently taking medications tends to be what is most helpful for maintaining kind of the reemergence of symptoms and reducing rates of hospitalization. But in order to do that, people have to feel like it's giving them more benefit than creating more problems.
And it has to require so much patience, too, because you're talking about possibly taking different types of medications and then also shifting the dosage. And so when you make changes, I imagine it takes weeks to know if a change is good or bad. And so this sounds like it takes a lot of patience.
Mm-hmm. It's very frustrating.
Your journey with medication was one that at the beginning, that was just it. It was the beginning. And then you had to go through this process, like increase the dosage. No, this one is causing side effects I can't handle, so let's try something else.
Yes.
Is that what
was what happened. I went through a stretch of, I think before, it was 2003. So I was diagnosed in the mid-90s. And it was 2003 before I got on an antipsychotic that actually worked well for me. And then they switched my antidepressant. And that helped me get motivated to go to the gym and start to eat right and stuff. And then finally to manage sleep, I take an anti-anxiety because at night I get anxious and then the anxiety turns to paranoia and the paranoia turns to auditory hallucinations.
That's currently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but if I take an anti-anxiety medication, I can cut that off at the pass. So I have a different psychiatrist now than I did when I started. And so the current psychiatrist is so cool.
And that makes a big difference, too, because you may initially not be paired with someone that's a good fit for you.
Yeah.
And so do you encourage other people to do that, to stick with
it? Shop around. Mm-hmm. Yes. If someone is not listening to you, if someone does not consider you part of your own treatment,
right,
then I would say yes.
You don't want someone dictating to you. You want someone listening.
I certainly do not want somebody dictating. I want to have a say in my recovery.
And I think that's an important thing to stress because a lot of people feel like they aren't in a position where they can disagree with a psychiatrist or a psychologist or another provider that they're working with.
It's an intimidating environment.
It can be quite intimidating.
Can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so really reinforcing for people that you have an absolute right to be an active voice in what's going to be best for you in your treatment and to be working with somebody who sees you as an equal partner in coming to those joint decisions of what's going to help you live your highest quality of life. That's important.
Right. And have they gotten better over the years?
Yes.
So there have been a couple of generations of antipsychotic medications. Currently, second generation antipsychotics are most widely used. They have fewer long-term side effects than some of the first generation antipsychotic medications. And depending on the person, we still do prescribe first generation antipsychotic medications if the second generation aren't being really effective. Again, it's kind of an individual basis. There are so many different medications really to choose from, though, that finding that person you can work with to do the slow work of finding that right one for you, it can take time, but it is possible to find what that right medication for you is.
And before we started the show, I got a message on Twitter from a woman named Leah, and Leah tweeted this: "I'm really looking forward to the show. I was raised by a parent with schizophrenia, and while we had a lot of challenging times, it also imparted a lot of gifts into my life, such as awareness and empathy. My stepdad was creative, funny, and more than his disorder." So thanks for that comment, Leah. And doctor, I do want to ask you, what causes schizophrenia? What do we know? Are people born with this, or does something happen in life that can trigger it?
That's a really good question. So there's a lot of research that goes into the different causes and contributors for illnesses like schizophrenia. And there's a lot that we still don't know. Our best understanding is that there's a combination between a biological vulnerability or predisposition to developing the illness and then stressors. Mm-hmm. So there are genetic or heritable components. So for people that have a first degree relative with schizophrenia, they are more likely to develop schizophrenia themselves, though genetics are not the only explanation for schizophrenia. And we also know that for individuals that are maybe predisposed, that external stressors really can trigger the onset then of the illness. So
what does that mean?
Well, so thinking about, again, this time of life when people most typically develop schizophrenia, late teens, early 20s, it's a time of high stress, figuring out where am I going to go after high school? How am I going to get a job that can support my own apartment? Relationships are really important, starting to have more serious romantic relationships. It's a time of high stress. And when an individual has this predisposition, the way that they're impacted by stress can put them in a more vulnerable state to developing psychosis. It's also a time when people are using a lot of alcohol and other substances, and we know that particular substances like marijuana, for example, can also greatly increase a person's risk of developing psychosis. There's a number of different factors mm-hmm. that all interact with one another.
And I was surprised mm-hmm. to read that there is no cure. It's a chronic illness with no cure?
Correct. So it is a chronic illness. It is not something that we have a cure for, but it's absolutely treatable. We have medications that can help with the different neurotransmitters, in particular dopamine in the brain, that are really at play in symptoms of psychosis or schizophrenia. And then we also have a lot of psychosocial treatments. And so what I mean by that is talk therapy, really helping mm-hmm. people learn how to recognize symptoms they're experiencing, how to go through an evaluative process to explore, okay, this thought that I'm having, is there evidence for or against that thought in the environment? Are there people that I can bounce this idea off of to see what might make sense, or to check out these voices that I'm hearing to see if that's something that I'm experiencing internally or if that's something that's happening around me?
So it's not enough to be medicated. You need therapy, talk therapy as well.
So I always think of it as there is a combination that is going to give somebody the greatest recovery. It's a combination of medications, which can really reduce symptoms, can not always alleviate or completely eliminate the experience of symptoms, but then it helps take the edge off so that some of these other psychosocial interventions can be more effective. So that when a person is hearing a voice, they have a greater ability to really be able to evaluate the presence of that, or is that something internal, than just medications alone or just therapy alone.
Christy, can you speak to that? What's been the value of having a therapist to talk with as well as having the medication?
Okay. The therapist that I have now, I've had for over 15 years. So it's a relationship where I can just easily talk to about my symptoms to someone that knows the science mm-hmm. behind it, you know, and knows the behavior behind it. It's mm-hmm. it is extremely helpful. We have worked through so many problems over the years. The medication, like she said, just alleviate some of the symptoms, but you know, life's hard, and you have to use all the tools that you can get a hold of. You know, there's also community, family, your therapist, and your psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to pull everything together to make it work.
Because friends can try to help, but may not always be helpful.
Well, friends, you know, I think of this one example. Early on, I was very open about my illness. I wanted people to know if I started to have a psychotic episode to not be scared, mm-hmm. right? So I was always open about my illness, which is not the case for some folks. But this one friend in particular, every time I started to show symptoms, she would start talking and to me like a little kid, like in a baby voice or something like that. Freaked me out. And so I had to, when I was feeling better, I had to let her know, just talk to me normal. Don't talk to me like a little kid or like mm-hmm. I'm not understanding you. And she's like, oh, okay. I'll do that. And she
so
never
she was probably seeing you saying, oh, she's fragile. She's vulnerable right now. And then that was her way of showing you care.
Right. Possibly. And it just messed with me. It just messed with me. But yeah, it was, I would say the therapist is really important because they bring this expertise into the yes. conversation. Mm-hmm. It's someone you can be open with. And yet they're coming back to you with a vantage point of expertise, whereas your friends are coming to you with the best intentions.
Mm-hmm. And love. Mm-hmm.
And love. And love,
right?
Yes.
All right. Well, I want to bring our listeners into the conversation. We have lots of folks who are on hold and who have called in and want to talk. This is Dave in Minneapolis. Good morning, Dave.
Well, good morning. I want to thank both of you for coming on and sharing your experiences so much. And you're right. Friends can provide a whole lot of love that is hard to find anywhere else. For instance, in the healthcare system, it's sometimes hard to find love. I have a different diagnosis, and one of the situations I find most frustrating is when you've developed a great relationship with a doctor, or you finally got a cocktail, if you will, that works, and then your insurance provider steps in and says, oh, we're not going to pay for that anymore. Mm-hmm. We're not going to pay for you to see this individual anymore. What do you do? You know, have either of you had this sort of experience before? How do you navigate it? You know, you talked about stress being one of the things that triggers
right
activities so much. How do you deal with that?
Thank you, Dave. He has a question about insurance.
Yeah. So, Dave, this is such a perfect point because one of the things that I see all of the time working in the healthcare world is that insurance companies will make decisions about what medications are part of their formulary or aren't, or which providers are in network versus not in network. And it can be incredibly disruptive to someone's care when their provider has to change or their medication has to change because of insurance. I know that there are lots of discussions happening at the state level to really look at mental health parity in the healthcare system so that the same level of care and support that's available for other kinds of physical health treatments are also the case for mental health treatments. Because it's really, absolutely, it's an increase in stress, which then puts a person at a greater risk of having worsening symptoms, mm-hmm. You know, when they're having these changes.
Christy, have you had some insurance company battles?
Oh, yes. I like the saying that the healthy Christy takes care of the sick Christy, because when I'm having mm-hmm. symptoms, I can't deal with insurance companies. I, you mm-hmm. know, I can barely talk to my doctor. So when I'm healthy, I make sure all premiums are paid, mm-hmm. All meds are filled. But the antipsychotic I'm on every year is denied by my insurance company, and the doctor has to write a note saying that nothing else works for me mm-hmm. and this is absolutely the only med that works, and they have to make the special step. And so in January, I'm teetering on a few pills, and it's very expensive. I wouldn't be able to do it out of pocket. So it's extremely stressful every year. Is this insurance company just going to flat out deny me on the only med that works to make sure I don't have hallucinations? Because mm-hmm. if I weren't medicated, then I would be institutionalized. I mean, there is no doubt about it.
But that's a common remedy, right? To have a doctor, you know, write a letter to challenge an insurance company's decision. And that can sometimes reverse a decision.
It can sometimes reverse a decision. I think what, you know, Christy's really highlighting is it is this extra step that an insurance company has denied mm-hmm. somebody their needed medication for a chronic illness. Mm-hmm. And then letters have to be sent that can delay time, that can then people find themselves rationing
right.
out their medications while they're waiting. And there's mm-hmm. that fear of, well, this may be the year the insurance company decides, I don't care about the letter. We're not going to approve it anyway. And it's just, it's really a horrific system.
I want to bring in Carol, who is listening in Marshall. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning. I have a question. I would like to know, I have a son who's bipolar schizoaffective, and is there a difference between schizoaffective and schizophrenia? Mm-hmm.
And another person has that question, too. Schizoaffective. That's a term I had not heard before, doctor.
Yeah, that's a great question. So schizoaffective disorder is also a serious mental illness, and it differs in some ways from schizophrenia. The ways that they are similar is that they are both primarily characterized by these symptoms of psychosis that we've been talking about, so hallucinations and delusions. With schizoaffective disorder, there's also an affective component. So a person may also experience mood episodes of either a manic episode or a depressive episode or just depressive episode. So there's an overlay in schizoaffective disorder of both the psychotic illness as well as a mood illness.
Mark is listening in Duluth, and I want to bring him in the conversation. He has a question as well. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. So I have a younger brother who has been diagnosed with schizophrenia about 7 years ago. He's been in institutions twice now in a total of about a year and a half that he's spent in two different psych wards with two different psychotic breaks. And from what I'm hearing, it sounds like a therapist is probably a really good addition to what he may need, because I know he has an ACT team, they call it, out of Wright County is where he's at. And he's being cared for, and he has a regular nurse that comes three times a week to my parents' house where he currently lives. And I was just kind of curious of, you know, the next steps we can kind of help him ease into trying to understand his diagnosis and trying for him to come to terms with it, because he's kind of delusional at most. And I guess, you know, doesn't really necessarily hear voices, but he's got some, you know, it's been hard trying to do it from a distance as a brother, but mm-hmm. I don't know, I just was looking for advice.
Mm-hmm. Sure. That's Mark in Duluth. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, so the ACT team that you mentioned, so those are assertive community treatment teams, and they are an interdisciplinary approach where they spend most of their time out in the community, coming into people's homes to provide care. Many people that have serious mental illnesses may benefit from ACT teams. You know, to your question about whether your brother would benefit from therapy on top of that, some ACT teams offer therapy, so that might be something to look into if he's already established there. I think also, you know, encouraging him to take part in a supportive, collaborative therapy relationship can be really helpful. The thing about engagement in any kind of treatment, including therapy, is that if the individual person is not interested or doesn't see value in doing that, the therapy isn't going to be as effective. So I think for families, one of the ways that you can really support loved ones is by providing encouragement and reinforcement to maybe giving something a try, you know, seeing if you can partner on seeing a therapist maybe four times just to kind of get a sense of it and, you know, see if that's a way that they might be more open to trying an additional part for their treatment.
Christy, I want to make sure we spend some time talking about your work, because you are able to work full time.
Yes.
Yeah. So you work. We mentioned the work that you're doing as a peer specialist at Avivo. So talk to me more about that and what happens at Avivo and what do you do in interacting with folks there?
Oh, sure. Well, I'm an artist and I work in the art department at Avivo. So it's the program is called Avivo Artworks. And there's a couple of components. We're located in a community support program. So that is basically a drop-in center for adults with severe and persistent mental illness.
In Minneapolis.
In Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. The location, there's one in Bloomington and there's one in Crystal. But the ART program is based in the Minneapolis location, which is on 19th in Chicago. So in order to access the ART program, you become a member of the CSP. So you have a diagnosis and you have to be actively seeing a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And then there are a lot of programs in the CSP, or you can just go and hang out and play cards. The ART program is twofold. We have open studio time where any member of the CSP can come in and utilize. We have a ton of art supplies. We have space to make art. We have supportive staff. And, of course, the other members are awesome. And so there's a few afternoons a week where open studio is available for people. And I help facilitate open studio. So I make sure people get the supplies they need to make the art that they want to make.
May I ask, what is it about the artwork? Is it healing you're a painter, correct?
Yes.
One of the things that you do. Yes. Is it something healing about that?
Well, I'm not an art therapist, but I know if I don't make art, then I start to go crazy. So for me, it is healing. For a lot of people, it is, I'm sure. But the other aspect of the program is we have a group of 15 collective members, and it's an artist collective, and those are professional artists that we support in their career, and they go through an application process, and they're fantastic. They help support other members and what they want to do. We help folks find exhibitions and help folks with grant writing.
It's a community.
It is a community. It is a community. Yes.
I want to bring in one of our listeners who is an artist. This is Kimberly in Minneapolis. Go ahead, Kimberly.
Hi, Christy. This is Kimberly. I'm an artist, and I partake in Avivo. And I just want to say two things. One is you are way more than a staff who helps artists find materials. and I say artist, and then I say also that I have a chronic mental health issue, or more than one. And then I also want to say, will you say something about the effect of being seen as either an artist first or a diagnosis first?
Right.
This is great.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Kimberly.
Thank you, Kimberly.
Thanks for calling in. Yes, I see myself as an artist first. I have a chronic illness, and it's something that takes a lot of effort and time to take care of. But my art comes first. My life comes first. I make sure I spend a lot of time with friends. I enjoy my life. I am not just constantly working on not being psychotic. I'm working on my artwork. I'm working on a graphic novel.
I'm holding the graphic novel in my hand.
You have a comic.
I'm like, we
yeah.
can't forget to talk about the graphic novel.
Yeah.
So tell us about this. It's called Crazy Like a Fox.
Yeah, it's Crazy Like a Fox, Adventures in Schizophrenia. So I've been telling stories about my experience with schizophrenia for years, and it's been boring my wife to death because she gets to hear the same stories over and over again. So I decided to write it down. And since I'm not a writer, I'm more of a storyteller and an artist, I decided to also draw it. And so this is the fox is the main character, and Fox is me, and goes through the situations I've been through. So the chapters are stories I've been through, and what you're holding is one chapter.
I'm looking at your drawing of the psychologist.
Yes.
This is great. This is great. Who do you hope sees this?
Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody. Yeah. I'm wanting to start conversations. And I think a lighthearted approach is the way to do it, because it's very, it's fun. It's fun. And, you know, but it's also, I have a studio at the Solar Arts Building, and we have First Thursdays, and people can walk through and come into artist studios. And when people pick up the comic, I've had people laugh. I've had people literally cry at Art World this last weekend. This young man read both of the comics, and he reached out his arms, and I'm like, oh, he's going to give me a hug, congratulating me on my work and stuff. And then he just held on to me and started sobbing, and he was like, you get it. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. And he's like, no, you get it. And so I didn't realize it could be so powerful, but if I reach one person, then it's worth it.
You get it, and you're sharing it.
And I'm sharing it, yes.
So, Dr. DeMarais, I want to make sure we talk about intervention, early intervention. Mm-hmm. Is it ever too late to get help? I mean,
No, it's never too late to get help. I think for any person that might be listening, for themselves or for a loved one, you know, if you're experiencing any sort of mental health challenge, regardless of how long it's been going on, it is never, ever too late to get help. We know that early intervention, whenever possible, is going to offer the greatest outcomes, the greatest,
best outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the greatest recovery. And so, like in the HOPE program, we are an early intervention program. We're working with people who are just being diagnosed with schizophrenia. We've worked with people where it's just been over the past couple of weeks, or where it's been going on for maybe the last year, year and a half. The way that I think about early intervention as being really important is you can help somebody get their life back on track before they've experienced so many losses, before it's been so much time that they have been out of college or out of work. And I think it's also a really great way to help people learn how to advocate for their treatment before they have a lot of negative experiences with the mental health system.
Yes.
So helping people learn you have a voice, you are the most important person in the room, and you need to be with providers that recognize that and that can really support you in getting to what your goals are.
And to keep trying.
And to keep trying.
All right. Well, I want to thank our two guests today. I've enjoyed this conversation very much, and I hope it has helped educate people. I know I learned a lot. Dr. Marielle DeMarais, a licensed psychologist with Hennepin Healthcare, and Christy Furness, a Twin Cities artist who is living with schizophrenia. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at @AngelaDavisMPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.